The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com, I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. We've got the New York Times best-selling author, Vicki Pedersen. She has a brand new book, a brand new series, a start of a brand new series. The book is called The Taken. Vicki, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right, The Taken. What's the series called?
The series is called Celestial Blues. So it's inspired by my love of crime fiction and noir and, you know, things that go bump, but not necessarily paranormal. I had to add that myself.
Right now, you know, a New York Times bestselling author, you've got other books out there. What is the difference with this genre that The Taken's in as opposed to maybe your other books?
Well, I've done this before. Kind of written something that I didn't really know what it was and where it fit in. The first time it actually fit into the urban fantasy genre, which has really exploded in the last few years, and that started with The Scent of Shadows and the Signs of the Zodiac series, and that has concluded at 6 books. So this is the first in a new trilogy, and I didn't want to write the same heroine. In my first series, my heroine was extremely tough, and you know, she wore a lot of leather, and she was very martial. And I couldn't envision anybody stronger than her. And plus, I didn't want to write the same person again. So this, I just, once again, threw a lot of things into the pot and wanted to come up with something different. Because one thing my readers do tend to write and comment on is how different the first series was. And I wanted to give that to them again. So this is actually what we're calling supernatural noir. It's not urban fantasy. And I think, you know, I've got to make that distinction right out of the gate. Because if people are expecting that all of the things that stick out in the urban fantasy genre, they're not going to get exactly that. They are going to get the supernatural. They are going to get action. But this is mystery heavy. So I've pulled the supernatural back, even though my male protagonist is an angel, and then I've pushed the mystery up front. So it's supernatural noir.
You know, reading this, I just want to look out the window and I see like maybe some fog. I see a lamppost. Mm-hmm. And this guy maybe in suspenders, dressed maybe what, in about the 1950s with maybe a lucky strike?
That's exactly right. The 50s is his era. And I love those characters. I love those movies. In fact, a lot of the readers, now that I'm finally getting commentary back on this because I had to hold it in. And it was just for me for so long. And so that's really lovely. But there, people are saying they can see it as a movie. You know, they can see it as an old black and white. And indeed, the two main characters, I have a male and a female protagonist in this series, and they're based very loosely on Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy and that on-screen dynamic they had, that push and pull, the male-female, you know, war relations, and you know, and yet they're a partnership. So I really love those movies, and I love that era, and I really wanted to bring that onto the page. So there's part of that, too.
All right, tell me a little bit about the angel. I mean, he has been thrown out of where he's at. You know, I don't think he was really at the top of, like, heaven. He was kind of in the middle. He was bringing people across the line, kind of making them feel comfortable. But the poor guy lost his wings. Well, tell me a little about him.
Yeah, Griffin Shaw is kind of a low man on the celestial totem pole. he, as a former mortal who was killed in 1960, he is now employed as a centurion. And centurions are, they take the newly deceased and specifically the violently deceased. Anyone who's been murdered or dies abruptly and it might find it a bit shocking for that soul into the everlast, into the afterlife. And that's his job. And in doing that, he's supposed to be able to work through his own issues and having died quickly and horribly and then therefore be able to move on after that. Griffin Shaw has a bit of a problem doing that because he, you know, remembers piecemeals of his own murder, but his wife was killed at the same time, and so he's having trouble getting over that. So he doesn't really want to move on. He kind of wants vengeance. He kind of wants to find out, you know, who killed Griffin Shaw, and that is the question driving the trilogy. And of course, that's what we'll find out at the end of the trilogy. So each book has its own present day mystery, which they work to solve together, and then the mystery that is driven throughout the trilogy is who killed him. So
I think his wife's in a better place, isn't she?
Well, I mean, very, very possibly, but that's not good enough for Griff. He really wants to know. So in going back to Earth, like you said, he loses his wings for a small infraction. He's not someone just to kind of take orders. And he gets involved with one of his charges, somebody who's supposed to die and does not because of his interference. So now he's charged with keeping her alive long enough for her, she's a reporter, to be able to help him find out who killed him as well. So they're really helping each other.
You know, when Griff loses his wings, they're more or less just ripped right out, and you can almost feel that. I mean, you can feel those wings. I mean, I don't have wings myself, but I can feel my back almost in pain. How do you get the pain across like that to the reader?
You let the reader kind of use their imagination. You know, I don't like to describe every single detail, but if I can give you enough sensory detail, I think the best writers let the readers do the heavy lifting. So if you saw that, then you have a wonderful mind.
Well, you know, and not only that, but things in here are so descriptive, and you say that you're really not over-describing them, which mm-hmm. I really appreciate, because some authors really do. When you first started writing, was that something that you've always had, that sense of not over-describing, or was there a time maybe that you did, you know, if you look back today, that maybe you did over-describe?
Oh, sure. You know, you learn as you go along. I think a lot of it is learning what I like to read. You know, I've always been a big reader, you know, far longer than I've been a writer. And so I knew what I liked to read and how I don't need the blow-by-blow. I'm pretty smart. I can figure it out. And so I don't want to talk down to my readers.
So you've got pretty smart readers is what you're saying.
My readers are brilliant. Are you kidding? Yes.
Well, let's talk about the ladies in this. I mean, Nicole, she was killed violently, and we see Griff here. He doesn't really understand, I don't think, how or who she was. Now, when you're coming down like that to escort the person over the line, you really don't know who they are or what they've done?
Yeah, Griff's job is just to clean him up and take him home, you know? So he as the Centurions get there in the moments right after a person has been murdered, generally. And so he doesn't know the circumstances. All he knows is there's this bewildered soul that needs escorting because they have a little bit of trouble getting there on their own. They're a bit shell-shocked. So he's not the gentlest guide, however. You know, he's got a really gruff persona, and he's kind of cranky. He doesn't really want to be there. He's doing it because it's his duty. And so, but he does feel for his takes. He does feel for Nicole. So when he realizes that she has to spend eternity dressed the way she is, and she's dressed, you know, for a case, she's dressed as a prostitute. They're trying to infiltrate what they think is a prostitution ring. And so he really feels bad for her because really nobody should have to spend eternity in latex. So he allows her to change clothes, but in doing so, she plants a clue that kind of gets Kit involved, and so therefore Griff is directly influencing, you know, the turn of events. You know, he can't just sit back and watch people die and watch another woman die, indeed another woman, because of him, because that, you know, echoes his wife's death.
Yeah, now Kit, she kind of is a newspaper heiress in a sense. I mean, it's owned by the family, so she works for the newspaper that her family owns?
That's right, but she's, you know, it's kind of like a crumbling castle, you know. She's working really hard to keep the family business alive, and she's doing, you know, investigative reporting and work, you know, wants to break the big stories and wants to break them first. So heiress might be a little too strong of a word, because she's really having to hoof it. But she's a strong-headed woman, and she's got a lot of strength. She's very girly. She's rockabilly. She's a rockabilly reporter. The two don't have anything to do with each other, but she lives a rockabilly lifestyle, and she happens to be a reporter. So she's girly. She likes her pin curls, and we can discuss rockabilly a little bit if you want to. But
I'd love to. What is rockabilly?
Well, rockabilly is this modern-day subculture that grew up around the love of the rockabilly music in the 50s. But now it encompasses, you know, the hairstyles, the clothing, the cars. There's a big car culture attached to it. So, you know, the people who live this lifestyle, they'll wear vintage. They drive, you know, the vintage cars. Nothing later than 1960 or 63 really is, you know, approved of. You know, there are people who go so far as, you know, outfitting their entire homes, which they won't leave unless everything is in place. So,
well, yeah, I think she also goes online to buy vintage cigarettes.
Yes, everything. I mean, she's obsessed with the era. And that happens to be the era that Griff is from. So they are, in some ways, each other's kryptonite.
So how much research did you do on rockabilly? I mean, that really does exist.
It really does exist. I found some people locally in Las Vegas, and I interviewed them. I took them out to coffee, and in one instance, apparently the tiki bar and tiki culture, you know, which was, you know, popular back then as well, is also a part of this. So I had to go drinking at a tiki bar. It was awful. It was really, it was hard.
Somebody had to do it.
You know, drinking rum drinks in the middle of the afternoon and scribbling notes so I could describe it. But, you know, somebody has to write that book.
Well, The Taken, it does take place in Vegas also. Why Vegas?
Well, I was born and raised there. And my first series is also set in Vegas. It's the only thing, the setting is the only thing that I carried over from the first series into this series. And I simply wasn't done with it yet. You know, it's not because write what you know. It's really, I have such a love for the city, and I really wanted to show parts of it that people visiting might not get to see on the surface. So you know how it is. When you're local to someplace, you want to share those pockets that you love. And so I include real life locales in all of my books. So in this one, for instance, Frankie's Tiki Room is one of those real life locales, and there's a big scene that takes place there. So just little bits of homage to my city that I love.
Well, you know, Vegas constantly changing. I mean, mm-hmm. really, I mean, back probably in the 50s, 60s, a lot smaller. And I'm sure with the series, you're going to be visiting, if you haven't already in The Taken, going back to the 50s of Vegas. Now, if you're going to do that, how much research have you done, or are you going to have to do?
Well, Griff, you know, obviously remembers that time. And so I'm visiting places in the series that he remembers in one way, and yet Kit experiences and has knowledge of in an entirely different way. And also, there are some people that are still around and still alive in modern day that were around when Griff was there, but they're 84 years old now, and he's stuck in time. So that's an interesting dynamic, and I wanted to play with that. But a lot of it, the research, honestly, on the Vegas was not difficult. It's kind of ingrained, and when you grow up in Las Vegas, you know, at least people who are my age, you know, you can remember a time when the mob ran the city, and everybody said, oh, it was a better time. It wasn't corporate. They took care of their, you know, employees like they were family, and there's kind of like a little bit of, you know, sentimentality attached to it. So there's a little bit of that in there as well. So I'm not saying that organized crime is good or anything, but there it was, and you can't ignore it. So it flavors the book.
What are the challenges? Now, you know, I really want to know what the challenge is, because you have somebody that has died and he's stuck in time. He's, what, probably in his 20s, early 30s?
He's 33.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And now he's going to be meeting some people who are like in their 80s. How do you look at that and say, okay, how is an 80-year-old person that was somebody like Griff, how are they communicating now? I mean, you know, what are the challenges there?
Well, they're not trusting their cataracts. You know, they're not trusting their eyesight. There's a little bit of that. There's a, you know, that question itself was very interesting for me to explore in this book, and I'm going to continue to do it. I'm 40 now and, you know, kind of looking towards the last half of my life. And so I'm looking forward and kind of wondering those questions myself. And what would it be like to encounter your younger self? What would it be like to be able to say things to a contemporary or of that time? Would they listen and vice versa? I don't know. There's endless possibilities and I'm not done exploring them because I'm not done writing the trilogy yet. But that was definitely, you know, a few of the fun scenes that they were great to write. I do have a character in there, Tony, who is Griff's contemporary, and they do have a lot of interaction and by play, and it's a lot of fun.
Wow! So in 20 years you'll be 40. That's fantastic.
Yes, yes, again.
Well, you know, this book right now, The Taken, you've already got probably the next book in the series finished, coming out in hardcover soon?
I'm finishing it up right now, yes.
You are.
Yeah, so it's pretty close. My editor's already seen it. I have notes on it. I'm rewriting it, and I'll still see it again another three times, I guess, before. But I'll be writing the third book by then, too. So.
Wow. So, how do you keep things straight when you're editing the second book, writing the third book?
Good question. It's juggling, you know. I guess you put on different hats, really. But fortunately, in writing a series, you stay immersed in the world and the characters, and you don't have to try and find that place again. It's not too difficult.
Vegas, a place that you know, uh-huh. Pretty much, I would guess.
Yes.
But do you have a timeline? I mean, to say, I've been here, I've done this in this book, now I have this, keep it straight. Do you have like a timeline on your wall?
I didn't in my first series, and I found that was to my detriment because I would have to go back and research my own books, you know, look in a 400-page novel for the one line that I needed, and that got a little tedious after six books. So when I started Celestial Blues, I did create a timeline, but I had to create the timeline not so much for the modern-day mystery, but for Griff's history. Where was he in, you know, 1959? Where was he in 1960? When did he die? And so on. So, and then keep that forward. And of course, when you're running two parallel mysteries, keeping the timeline straight is pretty important too. And through a trilogy, you also have to plant the red herrings and such. So it takes a little bit of organization, but I like it. You know, I my mind clicks that way. So yeah, I'll do timelines, note cards. I'll post things on my husband is poor thing, long suffering. You know, we'll paint the walls in our study, and then immediately I'll with tape stick up maps, and he's like, "What are you doing?" But I have to see it. So yeah, I do all of that extensively.
So how do you juggle your life, your married life, mm-hmm. with your author life?
Well, that's also a good question. I have parameters. When I'm working, I'm working, and the rest of the time I have to turn it off. I think that's something you learn as you continue in, you know, this is my seventh book. And I've already written my eighth. And so to have any sort of longevity, you really have to learn to balance it. One of my favorite authors, Nora Roberts, always says you have glass balls and you have rubber balls. And you can't drop the glass ones. So it's sometimes real life takes priority. And sometimes I, you know, hunker down in my writer's cave and I have to, you know, hit that deadline. So whatever's on the front burner, that's what I'll hit first. And you get pretty adept at moving in and out of it.
So you're not really treating it as a 9-to-5 job, or maybe?
Well, I can't actually write and focus my mind for 8 hours straight. I can't do that. I peter out around hour 4 or 5. So 5 hours a day on the writing side, plus, you know, whatever I need to do for promo or, you know, online or speaking with readers, you know, I'll add that to the mix. But a good 4 or 5 hours, and I'm pretty much tapped out for the day. Or if I'm writing a first draft, I'll do 2,000 words a day and be done. So those are kind of my personal, every writer's different. Some people write more than that. Some people write less, but I find that 2,000 words a day is enough to push me, but not, you know, utterly drain me so that the next day I'm useless.
If I wrote 2,000 words, how many pages am I looking at?
Oh, 8 to 10, I guess. I never know how many pages I'm writing. I go by words. So 1,500 words is around 5 pages, I guess. So, yeah.
So it's taken maybe about 3 months to write a book?
Yeah, first draft, I can do about 3 or 4 months, usually 4. because I do take time out for real life. I take weekends off for a family. And then another 4 to 5 months on rewrites, because it'll see, like I said, I'll go through it again another 4 or 5 times.
I find this to be a real interesting story. I mean, here's this guy that was alive on Earth at one time. He's dead now. He's bringing people over who have been violently killed, and almost feel sorry for him a little bit. He does tend to help him over to the light, I guess, would be a lack of a better term.
Sure.
How did you come up with the idea for this? I think it's a real cool idea.
Oh, I came up with the idea because I lost a contest. It was before my first book had sold, and I was waiting to hear back if it would sell. And I didn't want to start the second book in, you know, that series, not knowing if it had legs or not. So I actually entered, I had a little time on my hands, and one of my favorite authors was having a contest to win an ARC of one of her books. And an ARC is an advanced reader copy of a book, so you can get the book before it's even hit the shelves. And I loved her, but the contest stipulated you had to write a short story of 1,500 words, which, you know, as I said, that's a day's work for me now, but 1,500 words, and it had to have a paranormal element. So I came up with this idea of an angel who assisted people into the afterlife in the horrible moments right after their death. And so I actually lost the contest. There were 80 people, and I made it into the top, you know, 13, and that was the last I heard. But the top three got posted on her site, so I was like some loser in the top 10. Or the bottom 10, really. I could have been the 10th. I don't know. I do know that author now. Her name's Kelly Armstrong, and I tease her about it mercilessly. But the thing is that thank goodness it didn't get picked, and thank goodness it didn't get published on her site, because I think that would have taken away my need to tell the story. But the idea, even through writing my first series, wouldn't let me go. I knew it couldn't live in that incarnation, that it needed more, and I didn't have that more until I had his female counterpart, and the whole rockabilly thing really drew that together. But yeah, I mean, the success came out of that failure, so you never know.
I guess Griff was looking over you.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. The Taken, of course, it's out right now by the New York Times bestselling author Vicki Peterson. Coming out, what, 6 months? Another book?
Yes. I think it's 9 months. So March. The trilogy is going to be concluded pretty quickly. So you don't have to wait too long to find out who killed Griffin Shaw.
Cool. Well, I hope he continues on his life in the... next.
We shall see. I'm not taking orders, but, you know, you can tell me what your wishes are. We'll see what we can make happen.
I'll tap my heels together. You mentioned that you love reading. Now, do you read this genre? I guess with Kelly Armstrong, you do.
Yeah. Well, Kelly Armstrong, Kim Harrison, Charlaine Harris, those were kind of the forerunners of what's now known as urban fantasy. And it wasn't, I mean, they didn't even have a name for it when my first book came out. And when I submitted my book to my then agent, I said, I don't know what I called it, paranormal women's fiction. I had no idea what I'd written. I just knew I loved it. And I thought, somebody's going to love this as well. And she said, no, dear, this is urban fantasy, which was totally disconcerting because she was younger than me. She's like, no, dear, you don't know what you're talking about. And so that's why you get an agent, because they do. And so that, you know, urban fantasy then took off and evolved and became the monster success that it is today. But what was your question?
Well, I guess the question is, I haven't really gotten to the question yet. But,
oh, sorry.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. But do you read them you're writing?
Right. Yeah. No, I don't. So I read those three authors early on. I find that I cannot read in the urban fantasy genre. I was reading crime fiction. I was reading Dennis Lehane. I was reading noir. I was reading dark stuff. And there was no fantastical elements to it. So I thought, geez, Vic, you know, get a clue. Maybe that's what you should be writing. And yet, I really like that supernatural remove. It allows you to look at issues and look at things, kind of come at it from the side and intimately. So, and, you know, peer at it from a different angle. And so a supernatural move, I know that a lot of people won't read fantasy or science fiction because they, you know, it's a bit ghettoized to a degree, but I tell you, it can lend a lot of insight that maybe you didn't see coming.
All right, Vicki, tell me a little bit about your website. I'm sure you've got one out there.
Oh, sure. It's VickiPedersen.com. It's just my name.com, and you can go ahead and I'm there all the time. I'll do a blog, a weekly blog, so it's fine. I'll be there. If you talk to me, I will talk back.
Wow, really? So yeah. You get on the website quite a bit?
I do. I answer everybody who writes to me. I just think, you know, if you're reading my books and you're writing to me and you're taking that time, thank you, thank you, thank you, and I will absolutely write back. Yeah.
So how about book clubs? You do many of those, and I guess maybe somebody, you know, has a book club, they get your book, they want to do that, talk about the author, they can email questions, I guess.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm happy to do that. I don't do a whole lot of book clubs because when I'm not, you know, touring or promoting a new book, I'm generally writing one and, like you said, doing the life, the family balance. But there is one book club in Las Vegas that I couldn't resist. They were called the Sin City Book Sluts. And I thought, I have to go to that book club. I got to see what this is about. And you know what? I'm sitting right there, and they didn't ask me one question. They had cocktails, and they were, and I thought, well, this is kind of my kind of book club.
They even read it.
They did read it. I don't care. They buy it. I don't care if they read it. I don't even care.
All right, so the website, one more time, people can get there, they can see when you're on tour, they can see what's coming out, maybe they can even read a little bit about The Taken.
That's right. It's www.vickipedersen.com. So,
all right, well, the book is The Taken. It's by the New York Times bestselling author Vicki Pedersen. And I tell you what, you're going to love this book. You know, look out that window on a dark night. Maybe that guy outside by the lamppost smoking that lucky strike, that just might be Griffin. I hope not, because he can see stuff that other
people. Well, shoot, if you see him coming, I would run the other way.
Yeah.
Look over your shoulder.
But The Taken, I tell you what, it's a page turner. It's going to keep you up, and you're going to want. You can't wait for the second book in the series. I know I can't.
Thank you.
Vicki, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Vicki Pedersen, author of The Taken.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.